Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Follow me on Twitter at Brian Lehrer. Like me on Facebook at facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC. We have some last minute moving schedule parts in the show today, so we're actually going to do the Does the Pope Matter to Your Catholic Life call in a little later in the program. So think about that, Catholics, and get ready to call up with us. And right now, it is this week's installment of our weekly series for the month of March, Ask a Bioethicist. Now, three things you might not know about genetics. Did you know that you can get your own genome directly from companies like 23andMe? Did you know that even so-called anonymous de-identified genetic information can be re-identified? And did you know that DNA is being used by law enforcement not just for identity matching, but also to produce police sketches of suspects? Now, there are obviously good things about advancements in genetics, many, but there are serious privacy concerns as well. So that's what we'll talk about today with Duke bioethics expert Nita Farahani in this second installment of this month's series, Ask a Bioethicist. Professor Farahani, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And listeners, this is Ask a Bioethicist, so our phones are open for your questions. Have you ever faced a decision about whether to get swabbed, pricked, or sequenced? Have you ever considered getting your genome, but you're worried about what you might find? Have you thought about donating your DNA sequence anonymously for research purposes, but maybe you're worried it's not actually anonymous? Or anything else related to ethical questions about your genes or your genome? Call us up, 212-433-WNYC. Doctors, anyone else? 212-433-9692. And let's just jump in with one, Dr. Farahani, that we got from a listener on our Facebook page. And I think this puts it very well. This is from a listener named Mike. He says, I'm interested in having my genome sequenced, but I'm worried about what I might find. While it would be great to know of my genetic health risks so I could change my diet or lifestyle to combat these risks, what if I discover that I carry potentially harmful genes? This brings up a really difficult question, he writes. If the genes I carry make it very likely that my offspring may be born with a high likelihood of disease or illness, is it immoral for me to have children knowing this? What's your response to Mike?
So I think Mike has a valid concern, which is, what are we going to do with information once we find out about it? And what if some of the information that's there isn't as good as we had hoped? But the truth is, every genome has many imperfections in it, and all of us have risks to particular diseases. So, what I would say to Mike is, it's certainly worth finding out, particularly if he's interested in learning more about his predispositions. And he can find out a lot about not just his health predispositions, but other behaviors that he might not know that he has predispositions to. Now, is it immoral to have children once you know you have some abnormality? If we understand that everybody has abnormality, of course not. And if we move away from a genetic determinist perspective, which is genes cause behaviors or genes cause disease, then we start to understand that it's a much more complex picture than just genes to disease.
But what if genes do cause disease in some places? There are some diseases where you know that based on your genome, you have a 50% chance or a 25% chance or a 75% chance of actually getting a certain disease at a certain point in your life. So would there be a formula that you as a bioethicist would craft that has something to do with percentage likelihood, certainty that those genes would express themselves in that percentage chance, and seriousness of the disease, something like that?
Well, let me start by dispelling a myth, which is the 50 to 75% likelihood of developing a disease. Normally, what we tell people when we get genetic information and give it to them is you have a 50% greater likelihood than the population does. So if the population has a 1% risk and you have a 50% right, higher risk than the average population, it's really actually still a very small
risk.
Well,
that's one stat. I'm thinking of the classic Woody Guthrie, Arlo Guthrie thing, right, where supposedly basically Woody Guthrie's kids had a 50% chance of developing, was it Huntington's disease, I think? And that was considered just a straight genetic odds-making question, and Arlo Guthrie didn't get it.
So it's a little bit different than that still, which is if you have a disease-carrying risky gene, what's the likelihood that you'll pass it on to your children? Mm-hmm. And it depends on how many copies of that same gene you have. So if you are homozygous, which means both copies of an allele for a gene have abnormalities, then you have 100% likelihood of passing on one copy. And sometimes you need two copies in order to have the disease. But all that doesn't get at your question and the heart mm-hmm. of your question, which is suppose we do get to the point where we have much greater confidence about the risk that a particular person's genome will result in a child with a high likelihood of a disease. And one good example of this is something like Tay-Sachs, where people, particularly who are of Jewish descent, might have a higher likelihood of having Tay-Sachs in their genome. And so many of them, when they're choosing to marry and choosing to have children together, will both get tested for Tay-Sachs to see whether or not they're likely to have a child with Tay-Sachs that will result. You know, for particularly well-characterized diseases that cause significant suffering, it might make you think twice about conventional conception, and it might make you think a better way to go would be something like in vitro fertilization, which would allow you to do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to screen for one of the, you know, fertilized eggs or an embryo that isn't carrying that particular disease. So it could, under certain circumstances, mm-hmm. lead you to make different choices about how you would reproduce.
Reminiscent of our conversation last week about the bioethics of reproductive technology and how much it's ethical to choose the traits of your offspring. So interesting that that comes back up. But this week it is Ask a Bioethicist, Dr. Nita Farahani, from Duke, with us once a week in the month of March on these questions today on issues of genetic testing and sometimes privacy, sometimes other related questions. And Patricia in Manhattan has one. Patricia, thank you for calling in. Hello.
Thank you. Good morning. Yeah, I was kind of wondering, you know, knowledge is power, but knowledge is responsibility too. And having your genome sequence could become maybe part of the document of a prenup or a prerequisite, you know, in certain families. I myself was married, I'm now divorced, from a man who had chorea in his family. He said it was not Huntington's, but some other related, I don't know. I don't mm-hmm. feel like I ever got the right story. And his aunt died of it. And her children, one decided to have children, the other decided she would not. Because of the risk. But yeah, I was just wondering about requiring it of others. We talk about getting ourselves sequenced and making decisions, but we can make decisions on our future with other.
So is the heart of your ethical question stemming from your own experience that you married a guy who was not fully forthcoming about his own genetic profile when there was something serious you think he should have told you about?
As his aunts and uncles began dying of neurological symptoms, not all of them, but mm-hmm. a significant enough number of aunts and uncles,
right.
I started to wonder.
And so, Dr. Farahani, what a fascinating question.
I think that is a fascinating question. It makes me think of a couple of things. One is, in a number of states, in order to get an annulment from marriage, which makes the marriage, you know, void rather than voidable, as if it never existed. One of the reasons that you can do that is based on fraud. And so it just made me think, wow, I wonder if in the future we might have a complaint for fraud when somebody has fraudulently revealed their genome, or if they haven't, you know, been forthcoming, or if they've been deceptive in doing so. And it also made me think of another thing, which is my husband and I actually traded 23andMe profiles, I think probably on our second date. And, you know, it was more of kind of an interesting entertainment thing for both of us, which is we had both done it and we were both interested in what the other person's genome had, but it mattered a little bit to me and it mattered a little bit to him. So could we imagine a world in which, you know, thinking about and knowing another person's genome could be important information? Maybe. Do we, you know, do I expect that we'll get to the point in the world where we will rely so heavily on genomic information that we think it'll be a valid reason to void a marriage? Probably not, because the more we learn about the genome, the more we learn that really a lot of behavior and a lot of disease is based on the interaction between environment and genome. So genomes are just a tiny part of the overall picture.
Was it romantic to have done this on your second date?
Oh, it was. It was so romantic. It tells you something about our relationship, I think. I'm not sure good.
Maybe next people will put their genomes on their OkCupid profiles. But
let me just tell you something on that, which is there are websites that are dating websites based on DNA matching. And so you joke that people might add it to their OkCupid profile, but already they're talking about, you know, whether Match.com would incorporate it or whether other dating sites that are entirely based on DNA profile matching and searching for other people's, you know, genomic information will be a good business model. And it might be.
What details tend to get posted in those cases?
You know, I'm not sure. So I think, you know, it's I'm not sure to the extent to which they're actually, I haven't seen them. I haven't gone on to actually look at them, but I could mm-hmm. imagine that they would have some things about disease, some things about preferences. And, you know, some of it's based on quacky science trying to say that they can find who's a good match based on their genomic profiles. And I'll tell you, based on, you know, every other dating profile and website that tries to do matching, we haven't quite figured out the science of what makes a good romantic pair.
Tom in Brooklyn got sequenced. Hi, Tom. You're on WNYC.
Hi, guys.
So you got your 23andMe?
I did. I got it done kind of as a lark. I just thought it would be sort of a fun party trick, and I was sort of hoping to find out that I was, you know, part Black or part Native American or something. No dice there. But I did find out that according to 23andMe, I'm Jewish. My mom's mom apparently has some Ashkenazi genes, which I guess makes me Jewish.
Call and Madeline one, Albright.
1%, 1%, 2%, something like that?
It was about 10%.
Oh, wow. Okay, so higher. So that, you know, one thing that's very cool about the 23andMe profile, especially for men, because you get the complete X and Y side of things, is that you can do interesting ancestry testing. And people are learning a lot of interesting things about their ancestry that they didn't know. Sometimes they're learning that there might have been infidelity in the family that they were unaware of. And
23andMe makes a point of issuing a lot of disclaimers. You know, you can't unknow the stuff you're about to find out. Are you sure you want to proceed?
Right. That's right. When I did my 23andMe profile, they, you know, a couple of things they've sort of added a higher level of security to, which are for women, whether or not you have the BRCA1 and 2, you know, alterations, which increase your risk of breast cancer. And the other one is APOE3, 4, 2 status, which is the increased risk of Alzheimer's. And to get to those, they require that you do some video education and, you know, sign a number of additional disclaimers that say, I'm prepared to actually, you know, accept and receive this information.
Yeah, because that really could actually kind of rock your world a little bit. I mean, the most strange thing I found out, other than apparently being part Jewish, is that I'm a slow caffeine metabolizer, so no big deal in my case. But before you click on that link, you're like, ooh, what am I about to discover?
Yeah, absolutely.
So did you discover...
Go ahead.
Did you discover whether or not you can detect the metabolites of asparagus in your urine?
I already had personal experience of that. yeah, I can. And apparently my wife and I discovered this morning in my dogs, too.
Wow. Well, so that's one of the things that's really neat about 23andMe and different citizen science or direct-to-consumer genomic testing companies is that they're expanding our knowledge of what we can learn from the genome. With the asparagus metabolites, we used to think that some people, when they ate asparagus, they didn't have the smell distinctive of asparagus in
but
urine.
But well, it's just whether or not you can smell it, right?
That's right. That's right. Everybody's actually smells bad. It's just a matter of whether or not you have the genetic ability to smell it.
Huh. So, Tom, after you got your 23andMe test done, did you suddenly find ham and cheese sandwiches unappetizing?
Well, I couldn't really get to them through the pious that I suddenly grew. They were extremely long.
You thought, you know, those West Bank settlements, maybe not such a bad idea. After.
Exactly.
Tom, thank you for your call. I really appreciate it. Bill in Jersey City, a medical student. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm happy that you mentioned APOE234 sequencing because that's what my question is about. There was a time when I worked in a research-oriented cardiology practice, and they would often do that sequencing because those particular genes have some bearing on individuals' risk for different cardiovascular diseases. However, as you mentioned, APOE4E4 puts, if someone is homozygous for that gene, they're at a really increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And I was privy to a very interesting bioethical discussion, and I'm just curious what your reaction to this is. I don't want to say what that what those doctors decided on, but they said, well, what if we go ahead and we're just interested in this patient's cardiovascular disease risk, and we find out they're E4, E4 positive. Do we tell them that we found out that there's an Alzheimer's disease risk? Do we inform their primary care physician? Do we put this in their chart? Or do we have to disavow all knowledge because the patient never requested it?
Yeah. So I think this is a great question. Thanks for asking it, Bill. And, you know, the bioethical community is divided on this issue of direct-to-consumer genetic information and what information consumers should have access to. And APOE4 is one of the primary examples that they use, because what APOE4 tells you is if you're homozygous for that, that you have a significantly increased risk of Alzheimer's. And for the most part, we think that's not really actionable today, meaning if you have knowledge that you have an increased risk of Alzheimer's, there isn't much that you can do about it. Now, there may be some things, but it doesn't seem like there's a lot. So given the ways in which that can negatively affect a person, not just psychologically, but their ability, for example, to get something like long-term health insurance, which isn't covered by the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. So putting it in their file could be something that could be accessible by these companies or disability insurance. You know, what do we do with that information? Some people think people should have access to their information and the right to self-determination and autonomy means that they should. And other people think that all of this should go through doctors and that doctors should be in the position to decide. I personally believe that we should educate people about what it means, but that we shouldn't restrict access to information that people have available to them. But certainly people are of different minds about this issue.
Yeah, I don't know how much, the insurance issue came up in their discussion, but you know, one thing that did interest me was someone said, well, this guy is older. There was an individual who, you know, had this particular predicament. He thought, well, you know, this man's in his 40s right now. He may start, you know, developing signs of Alzheimer's pretty early, and we've got this information. What if he starts to wonder what's going on? He goes to his GP, and they have no idea what's happening. You know, as a healthcare provider, you may feel, you know, compelled, I'm in a position to offer my perspective on the situation, perhaps help this man find out what's happening. But again, you know, on the other side of the coin, you obviously have, you know, some certain ethical restrictions. And that I think is a difficult spot as a provider. If you know
absolutely.
What's happening,
absolutely. And it's not just with APOE4. So increasingly, when we're starting to do things like whole genome sequencing, and a provider runs a whole genome sequence, they're not necessarily trained to know all of the different findings that they may discover, and may not know what all of the implications of them are. And what's the duty on providers to disclose information and to educate their patients about everything that's within their genome? And what about when new research comes up and you have this big sample that might tell you a lot of things about that person? So, you know, we're trying to figure this out in the bioethical community, is how much of a duty do we place on providers to educate consumers, and how much do they tell them, and how much are they required to tell them? So these are hard issues, and they're ones that, you know, we're grappling with in every level of the bioethical community.
And Bill, thank you very much for calling in. And by way of segue, we're about to speak to New York City Councilman Jumaane Williams about some law enforcement issues, and DNA and genome sequencing even comes into play in law enforcement. So let me ask you one of those questions before you go. I gather that law enforcement is starting to use DNA to produce police sketches. And maybe some of our listeners heard about the exhibition called Stranger Visions on the WNYC show Studio 360 recently. Artist Heather Dewey Hagborg has used DNA to make lifelike models of people's faces. She made one of the hosts, Kurt Anderson, and he said he thought it looked sort of like a younger version of himself, but if it was for the purpose of a police investigation, it's definitely not a clear match. Is it just a technological gap that might be closed, or do you think there's a fundamental ethical question surrounding the limitation of DNA information, and it should not be used to create police sketches of people's faces?
So we've been using DNA for quite a while to do identity matching and to run it through databases to figure out if we can find a person who's left a sample behind. And it just turns out we may learn a lot more about the identity of the person, like, for example, just as one of the earlier callers talked about, their ancestry. And so if, you know, you believe that the suspect that you're looking for is of a particular ancestry and it turns out that the DNA tells you that they're from a different one, or you can do things like figure out the bridge of their nose or the likely eye color that they have, or even potentially their likely height, you can learn a lot of identity matching information from the DNA beyond just, are they a match to a sample that's in a database? Do I think that there's an ethical constraint to doing so? There may be. You know, it depends on whether or not you start building a detailed behavioral profile of a person and if we store that in government databases and, you know, who has access to that information and for what purposes it can it be used. But it's a pretty exciting thing to be able to know a lot of information about a suspect beyond just if they're in a database that we can match it to. And so I don't think I would stop that research from going forward or those uses from being from going forward. I would just be careful about the limits that we put on those uses.
All right. Well, folks, next week, more Ask a Bioethicist as we plan to talk about ethical issues surrounding neuroscience. Dr. Nita Farahani joining us once a week in the month of March for this Ask a Bioethicist series. So fascinating. Thank you again, Dr. Farahani, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we will talk to City Councilman Jumaane Williams of Flatbush about the police shooting of a 16-year-old over the weekend and the riot that followed on Monday night. Stay with us.